From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Powell. Aid organizations in Fiji are aiming to build Category 4 and 5 standard shelters in badly hit locations as yet another cyclone season nears. Coral Island was struck by Cyclone Wilson in February, claiming 8 lives on the island and wiping out most of the houses. While volunteers have been working hard for months to set a high sanitation levels, many families are still struggling from the lack of food and basic items. Alex Perote was there.
That's the sound of 325 kilometer per hour winds and a house being picked up and disappearing in the storm, taken from a video from the Think Pink volunteers in Tuatua village on Koro Island. Now, building supplies are arriving in proper quantities for the first time since the February cyclone, and they're being welcomed with open arms. Families have been living in tents that are now leaky and covered in mildew. A school teacher at Koro Island High School, John Rounds, says it's been a tough 6 months.
It's very sad to see the students without classrooms, learning in the tent during a hot, sunny weather. It's very hot inside the tent. We cannot teach properly. That's all happened to the student. We're still waiting for what the government will do. So mostly after this year or next year.
But schools will have to wait longer, because for now, homes are a priority. The chairman of Nangaindamu village, Niko Komainavoka, says they've received some materials but are waiting until higher land is properly cleared for new homes, and that's going to take serious government intervention and time. The next cyclone season could start within weeks, and he says Nangaindamu doesn't have any safe structure.
Safety plan is rebuilding what you have got right now, what material you've got right now. You have to make a safe house just in case of the hurricane season comes. At the moment, there's no safe house. Maybe there's a concrete house there. Just fix it up again and stay there.
Down the road at Nasau village, where 5 people died in the storm surge, ruins are still scattered everywhere. But there's a shed with piles of wood that has been cut from local forests. Chief Kelione Tamane says he used primitive methods of rolling logs to collect a lot of the trees that Winston cut down and a portable sawmill that he's now lending to other villagers. His words were translated by Oxfam aid worker Eleza Duwaimbe.
The process that they're doing, they have to pull hundreds of meters, big logs with ropes. They pull it towards the sawmill, and then they cut those timbers and then they lift it to the roadside. And then the trucks pick it up and they come and store it in the storage space that they have here.
But this is a wonderful story of people helping themselves and not relying so much on government, isn't it?
This is their own initiative. They want to do this for themselves, to quicken the process.
But Rusila Delangi and her brother Turakai are living in a tiny corrugated iron hut next to where their house once stood. All that's left is the fireplace and chimney.
Do you have the materials for your new house yet?
Yeah, no.
No, still waiting?
Not yet.
Still waiting. When will it come?
I don't know.
You don't know?
Uh-uh.
And did you lose anyone in your family in the cyclone?
No.
Where did you run?
I ran up there.
Health centre?
Yeah.
Oh, very good.
The chief, Kilione, says he too is waiting for land to be cleared to build new homes. And families like Rusila's, who live close to the shore, will have to relocate. In the meantime, the Director General of the Red Cross, Felipe Nainoda, says he's coordinating with Habitat for Humanity to make sure each village has something to gather in should a cyclone hit in the coming months.
We are working to ensure that at least in one community, one home is built that will be safe, that can take a cyclone and can be used as a shelter. So that's the current strategy that we have at the moment.
He says they will build 50 shelters around the island and will train local carpenters with detailed plans for small houses measuring 4 by 6 meters.
What we are going to do actually actually in with this project is actually also train community carpenters on how to build back better, how to use these building materials to build stronger, sturdier buildings that can withstand at least up to Category 4 or 5 cyclones.
Dr. Ravnil Singh was sent to Koro for his first placement 3 days before Cyclone Winston struck. He says the Fiji Red Cross Society, Oxfam and All Hands volunteers have successfully built temporary toilets, and he's amazed at the low level of infections. But he hopes the new homes have more permanent toilets.
We're targeting water-sealed toilets. So there's multiple NGOs that's helping with the waste disposal. So I guess that's going well. And I think the main thing now is the houses. So that leads to sanitation, infectious diseases, like typhoid and things like that, viral hepatitis.
Groceries are also arriving at the Koro Island store, but one family says they don't have the money to buy them. Kameli Karavaki is a farmer and says taro and cassava are vital for Fijians, but they are yearly crops and many of them won't be ready until halfway through next year.
We need more planting and we need more food, like the food ration being distributed to all villages. In this village, plenty house, we don't have any food. October, November, December, only the leftover food from the farm, it will take us. But next year will be a big problem.
His wife, Kalera, says they still need basic items.
Rice, flour, sugar, laundry, soap, like that. There's a store here. The only problem is we don't have money to buy. It's very tough. We don't have much money.
Volunteers have been on the island for months, living in tents. Ruben Grandin directs the All Hands volunteers and says it's a relief to see the materials coming in as they are heading out.
The tarps and tents are kind of at their end. It's probably been about 6 months or so since they came in, so it's good that Red Cross has more tarps to distribute, and it's really good to see the more permanent building structures coming in.
Philippe Nainoda from the Red Cross says they're sending emergency supplies in containers to islands like Koro and badly hit Vanuambalavu, so they are ready for the next big storm. But Koro is still in emergency mode and will be for a long time. This is Alex Perrottet.
Australia's government has been trumpeting its border protection policy to the world community as leaders converged at the United Nations in New York City for the General Assembly. The Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, and Immigration Minister, Peter Dutton, have described Australia's policy, including the controversial offshore processing of asylum seekers who arrive by boat, as a model for other countries. A lawyer who has representative refugees, Eric Vedlis, says he's embarrassed to call himself an Australian when the government says such things. He told Johnny Blades that allowing mistreatment of refugees and asylum seekers in Nauru and PNG's Manus Island are a disgrace, but the majority of Australians support it.
And the government feed off it. The government encourage it. You know, we've had our Attorney General come out and say, it's okay to be a bigot. We've got Pauline Hanson saying, I hate Muslims, I don't want Muslims here. You know, they seem to think that refugee equals terrorist, Muslim equals terrorist. If you're not a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, you're a terrorist. And the public love it.
So Peter Dutton has got a popular mandate then. What do you make of him saying that Australia is a world leader in investing in refugees? Because there has been a lot of money spent, for instance.
Look, the guy is a legend in his own lunchtime. They are spending billions of dollars in Nauru and on Manus. And why? There's no need for these people to be there. You know, we spend $4 billion on refugees on Manus and Nauru. I mean, that money could have built hospitals, roads, schools, social services. Both major parties, both the Labor and the Liberal Party, favour offshore detention. So when you've got 85% of the population vote favouring offshore detention, what hope have you got? I mean, the Greens are the only ones in this country. You know, they've got 8% of the vote. They're the only ones that are against offshore processing. And by the way, I think 92% on last count of these people on Manus and Nauru are genuine refugees. They've been assessed. It's not that they are not refugees. They've been assessed, but they can't go anywhere.
And David Ardiang, the Nauru minister up there at the UN, did say that there is a problem with resettlement. Nauru clearly doesn't want these people long term. I don't think the people necessarily want to be on Nauru either.
Nauru is a failed country. You know, they grow nothing. They import all their food. Australia props it up. If it wasn't for Australian money, those people would have nothing to eat. So, of course, they're going to support Australia and everything Australia says. I mean, it's ridiculous we have a prison on Nauru. It doesn't make any sense.
So you'd like to see them brought to the mainland, I guess, as soon as possible?
I would like to see the genuine refugees who've been assessed by international standards allowed into Australia, yes. And I understand New Zealand's offered to take some, but Australia said, no, we're not prepared to give you any. That I don't understand either.
In your dealings with some of the people who've been detained up there in Manus or Nauru, let's say, the human cost of being there, it's substantial, isn't it?
Well, they're in jail. You know, they're in jail for doing nothing wrong. They've got no idea why they're there. They can't go back. They'll be killed. They're not safe to go back where they came from. And, you know, you've got a government and an opposition that says, no, you're never going to come to Australia and nowhere else. Who's going to take them? I mean, I read recently that Italy got 40,000 refugees in 1 month. Australia offered to take 12,000 Syrian refugees. And yet, almost a year later, I think only 1,800 or so have come to Australia.
Pacific Island countries have called for help in dealing with refugees at a major UN gathering in New York. They're given delegates to the Refugee and Migrant Summit a glimpse of their own experiences and say countries need to cooperate more. Sally Round reports.
Nauru's Justice Minister David Adiang called for help to resettle the hundreds of refugees living in limbo on the island. He described Nauru's offshore regional processing system with Australia as an innovative model which had avoided thousands of deaths at sea. The camps on Nauru and in Papua New Guinea have been widely criticised, but Mr Adiang says Nauru's proud of the system, which he said had been effective apart from a crucial missing element.
Nauru invites other countries to assist in finding durable resettlement solutions for our refugees. This is the critical missing component. Remote processing is one part of what needs to be a comprehensive migration strategy. I encourage states today to assist us find permanent homes for the 924 refugee men, women and children currently on Nauru.
Mr Adiang even appeared to put out a bid for more processing business, saying it had the infrastructure and systems in place now and was well placed to address migration flows. Papua New Guinea's Foreign Minister Rimbink Pato took a forthright stand, suggesting countries be held accountable for the mass exodus of their people from strife. He says PNG's experience of the global refugee crisis included seeing Carteret Islanders forced to migrate internally because of rising seas and an asylum seeker processing centre on Manus Island. He says that was set up with Australia as a gesture of goodwill and is now being closed after being found unconstitutional. He says the experience shows it's not a simple issue.
Papua New Guinea's experience from hosting and providing migrants and refugee needs call for a shared global responsibility. This is why my country is serious and committed to be part of the global solution.
Mr. Pato recounted the low numbers wanting to resettle in PNG from the centre, and he recommended innovative methods like his country's waiver of a $3,000 fee for citizenship for refugees. Fiji's Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama says the world must approach the grave crisis in a way that puts human rights and dignity above all else. He says countries must make a more concerted effort to work together to deal with it.
And we hear the cries of those who are unfairly treated in detention centres, including in our own region, with no hope and no way out. Excellencies, our common humanity demands that we must heed these cries and work together more holistically and more effectively to address this crisis.
Mr. Bainimarama says Fiji has offered refuge to climate change migrants from Kiribati and Tuvalu, but he says that will need international help. Meanwhile, Australia defended its border protection policies, saying it's a world leader in investing in refugees.
Australia's immigration policies have focused on finding a balance between population growth, nation building and economic needs, while sharing the responsibility for resettling the most vulnerable refugees. The Australian story demonstrates how societies can benefit from safe, orderly and well-managed migration.
He says Australia's had a long history of managed migration and reiterated that people smugglers don't offer a path to the country. This is Sally Round.
The Catholic Church in Guam is fighting a last-ditch battle to defeat a bill that would expose it to lawsuits from victims of childhood sexual abuse. But critics say it's warning that civil claims would leave it bankrupt and threaten church services. Joe O'Brien reports.
A bill lifting the statute of limitations on civil action in sex abuse cases was unanimously approved by the Guam legislature last week. But the Catholic Church has now launched a petition calling on Governor Eddie Calvo to veto the legislation. Five historical abuse allegations have been made against the clergy in the past few months, and abuse experts say there are likely to be other victims who are yet to come forward. In a post on the Pacific Daily News website, Father Jeff San Nicolas says the resulting lawsuits would leave it in financial ruins.
The Archdiocese of Agana is not seeking to protect child sexual abusers. It simply desires the people of God to be well informed about the true effects of Bill 326-33. Bankruptcy of the local church would be inevitable.
Father San Nicolas says that would leave the diocese scrambling to keep open churches, schools, and social services. However, the Secretary of the Concerned Catholics of Guam, Evangeline Lewin, is questioning the accuracy of that claim.
Social services, a majority of it is paid by federal funds and are not impacted by any of this. The funding comes from an outside source as well as private donations. And Catholic schools are run by finances. They get very, very little support from the Archdiocese.
Evangeline Lewin is also critical of the church's motives, accusing it of putting financial stability before the need of abuse victims to heal. She says it's unfair to tell parents and children their schools may close, but she's wary of the influence the church wields.
Culturally, we respect the authority of the church. The church is a very important part of who we are as Chamorros. And when they're talking about losing these entities, it impacts people. And that's why we're in the situation we're in to begin with. It's ironic. They're using the same tools of threats to get their way.
Governor Calvo has until Friday to sign the bill, and Evangeline Lewin says she hopes he'll take the opportunity to support abuse survivors and clean up the church. But Archbishop Savio Hon Phai Thai has also spoken out about the threat the bill poses, warning similar legislation in other US states has resulted in bankruptcy for 13 dioceses. In Hawaii, a four-year window for childhood sexual abuse survivors to bring civil claims concluded in April. Mark Gallagher, a lawyer who represented many claimants in Hawaii, believes it was beneficial for the church there.
One of the surprising things that I've found in handling these cases is the number of individuals who are active Catholics who think that it's a good thing, that the church has been held to account and held to the standards that it teaches. So I think it's a question of sunshine is the best disinfectant.
About 150 claims were brought during the four-year window in Hawaii, the majority of which were against the Catholic Church. Mark Gallagher estimates the settlements have cost the church more than $20 million, which has been paid for through insurance and investments, and has not resulted in any closures. This is Joe O'Brien.
Many small islands in the Pacific and around the world are facing significant water stress. Most of the islands rely on groundwater that is replenished by rainfall. Researchers at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia, Canada, were asked to assess the state of this and in their report, which has just been published in the Natural Climate Change. The study author, Diane Allen, told Don Wiseman that what they found was that a lot of the islands are already facing stress because of water shortages.
Was carried out as a research contract for UNESCO as part of the Transboundary Waters Assessment Program. And even though small islands are not transboundary, there's one small island developing state that is a transboundary, there was a desire on the part of UNESCO to include small island developing states in the overall assessment. So the first part of this work was looking at what do we know about the groundwater conditions and water conditions a little bit more generally on 43 small island developing states that are distributed worldwide. And Of the many variables that we synthesized and compiled, there were two that were of interest to my research. And one of them is recharge and how much water is recharging the aquifers on these small island developing states. And when we did an assessment of this using a standard recharge model, applying the same model to all of these 43 islands, it turned out that many of them were showing signs of water stress at the current time. So we used an indicator of water stress, and surprisingly, a large number of them, 44% of the islands, were in a state of water stress as defined by this particular indicator.
And that's due to drought?
No, not due to drought. It's due to an imbalance between the amount of water that is recharging the aquifers on an annual basis and the amount of evaporation that's taking place.
Okay, so warmer climates.
Warmer climates, but not warmer looking into the future. This is current. So this is taking a look at the current amount of evaporation on these islands. So the bottom line, there's a limited supply of water on the islands, and some of the islands already have an indication that when you compare the amount of water that would be available compared to some other region of the world, 44% of the islands we looked at would be in a state of water stress in comparison to other areas around the world.
You also looked at the quality of this water or the threats to quality.
Right. We looked at the main thing on islands is the presence of a saltwater wedge, and there's a freshwater lens, that sits on top of freshwater, so it's a bit of a bubble. And if we take too much out of that freshwater lens and it's not replenished at a sufficient rate, then there can be encroachment of something called the freshwater-saltwater interface, which can lead to gradual salinization of the aquifer and essentially depletion of the freshwater supply. So that's a primary indicator of water quality concerns on these islands, but there are other concerns as well, just as there are in other places around the world, natural contaminants, for example, and agricultural contaminants like nitrate. So we looked at the available literature to say, well, how many of these islands are actually experiencing problems with their water quality as well, reported problems.
Did you isolate the solutions or what it is that these island nations can do to protect their water?
Well, one of the, I think, surprising aspects that came out of the review was that we took a look at various legal instruments, so laws and regulations surrounding groundwater, and we also looked at the institutional capacity in these small island developing states, and found that there was a very large percentage of the islands that really had very limited capacity to manage and govern their water appropriately. And I think as one of the major conclusions of the study, trying to improve on that overall governance of water on these islands would go a long way towards improving, for example, monitoring programs. So looking at the quality and quantity of groundwater over a long period of time. Surprisingly, there was a survey that was distributed to local experts, and we had a lot of help from UNESCO in trying to find who those local experts would be that could complete the survey on behalf of the particular small island developing nation. And on many islands, we had a terribly hard time trying to find somebody local who had knowledge of the groundwater system on the island, which suggests that local expertise is also lacking. And that wasn't really discussed in the paper that came out in Nature Climate Change, but something that I observed was the lack of experts on groundwater systems on these islands, despite the fact that groundwater is an important resource on many of the islands.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you'd like to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is very simple, focus@pcjmedia.com. That's focus@pcjmedia.com. You can listen to this program again, as well as past editions, by visiting our website, www.pcjmedia.com, and look for the link for this program, Focus Asia Pacific, on the right menu. Now, those of you who are listening to this program on shortwave and would like to receive the Focus Asia Pacific QSL card, make sure that you include as many details as possible, and also let us know what reception is like in your area. We've been getting actually a number of listeners actually in the Pacific who are tuning to our service, which is actually meant for Southeast Asia. So do let us know. Anyway, that's all we have time for this week. Until next time, friends, I'm Keith Powell wishing you well, and we'll see you in 7 days' time. For those in the Pacific, I just want to remind you once again that you can listen to the 3-time daily edition of the program. Until next time, so long and take care.
Yeah.